Welcome, members and guests, to the September 20th meeting of the City Club of Eugene. I'm Marty Wilde, City Club President. Our sponsors today are Harris Law Group and Dr. Sandy Ibarra and Dr. Gail Leslie of Hearing Associates, and also KLCC. And a special thank you to KLCC, as always, for broadcasting this show on Monday nights. Thank you, all, as always, also to KPFF Consulting Engineers for our office space. Welcome to our KLCC listeners and to our TV audiences on community television and the Oregon Wind Network. We are a member-supported organization. If you are not already a member, please consider a tax-deductible virtual or regular City Club membership, sponsorship, or donation. Today's presenter is Eugene Symphony Executive Director Scott Freck, who will bring us What Makes the Eugene Symphony Work. Past President Mary Layton will interview Mr. Freck. Her questions emerge from her rookie year as a symphony member. Please welcome Dr. Layton and Mr. Freck.
I want to welcome a special guest today, Caroline Beckelhide, who was one of the founders of the Eugene Symphony. At this time last year, Caroline, thank you. At this time last year, we were having a program about the building of the HULT. It was the 30th anniversary of the HULT, and it really was one of the most fun programs I ever had putting together. And one of the things that people said as I talked to them about how they happened to do this was, well, nobody thought we could support a symphony. That was just not happening. There were not enough people, not enough interest. It was not the right kind of thing. And 30 years later, the symphony is quite an amazing event. And I am reminded how much our world is shaped by people who do believe in these wonderful things and who work to make them happen, not just by writing checks, but by pounding pavement and talking to people and writing. Scott, So what happened was last year was my first year as a symphony. I was getting ready to retire. I started thinking about, well, what will I do with my time? And so I started going to the symphony. And I sit there in the cheap seats in row E and watch everybody play amazingly. And then I think to myself, who thinks up this stuff? How do they put these plans together? How do they know what's going to sound good as a program? And I met Scott at another civic organization meeting and started talking to him about it and thought, well, I bet we could make a program out of this for other people like me who do not spend their lives much thinking about this kind of stuff, but who in fact bump into it from time to time thanks to the fact that people are around who do. So Scott agreed to come, and this is what I've learned about him and why we should care about his opinions and why we should trust his judgment and engage him on the judgments involved in running the symphony. He's been the executive director for the symphony since June 2012. For the 12 years prior to that, he was vice president for artistic operations and general manager of the North Carolina Symphony, based in Raleigh. He began his orchestra management career at the Oregon Symphony in his hometown of Portland. During his nine-year tenure at the Oregon Symphony, Scott served as the marketing and public relations assistant, operations coordinator, director of orchestra operations, and ultimately artistic administrator. I mean, he was just a boy.
That's true.
Among other projects, Scott is particularly proud of the five CDs the orchestra produced during that time, as well as a series of three annual commercial TV broadcasts, one of which earned a regional Emmy Award. And lastly, the establishment of a groundbreaking series entitled Nerve Endings, which sought to reinvent the orchestral concert experience. And this kind of background sort of addresses my concern, was how does he think about this stuff? How does the person who manages the event figure out what parts will make it work? In his role at North Carolina Symphony, he oversaw all aspects of artistic planning and concert production, including orchestra personnel, venue relations, scheduling, artistic administration, and electronic media. In 2004, Scott managed the launch of the new monthly radio broadcast series on two listener-supported stations, All Classical WCPE-FM and NPR affiliate UNC-TV. He recruited nationally recognized broadcaster David Hartman to host the program and also served as the executive producer of the series. Scott's also an amateur musician. He's the product of public school system in Oregon. He played cello at the student level for 12 years and occasionally semi-professional and plays a little piano. He was a member of the Portland Youth Philharmonic, this country's oldest youth orchestra, for 4 years. So, Scott, what brought you back to Eugene?
Well, what a great question. First of all, very glad to be here. Nice to see you all. Let's see. 12 years in North Carolina. It was a 3 to 5 year plan. We moved to Raleigh from Portland in the fall of 2000 with a newborn child, thinking we'd give it a try, see how it went. 3 to 5 years, maybe 6 years tops. And 12 years later, we found ourselves looking to come home. My wife is also from the West. We thought it's time to come back and be near our families and rejoin the tribe. So here we are.
How ordinary is it for a city the size of Eugene to have a symphony? And it's a pretty good symphony, I hear, from people who are able to evaluate these things. How come we can have a small town in a great symphony?
Well, I'll throw some facts and figures at you first. To start with, there are something like 1,800 orchestras in the United States, ranging from professional to community and youth orchestras and university orchestras. So that's an average of 36 orchestras for every state. So it is fairly typical to have a symphony in your town. Of those 1,800, probably 900 or somewhere on the spectrum between community orchestra and professional orchestra. I did a little random sampling of cities of Eugene's size and did a little research. So just throwing out a few comparable towns: Tallahassee, Florida; Huntsville, Alabama; Overland Park, Kansas; Tempe, Arizona; and Dayton, Ohio. And of those five, three of them have orchestras. The two that don't, Overland Park, Kansas, is basically in the shadow of Kansas City, where they have an excellent orchestra, and Tempe, Arizona, obviously in the shadow of Phoenix. So those are the two outliers. The other three have, I think, very good orchestras. Dayton, particularly, I think, has a strong one. For whatever reason, there's a lot of orchestras in Ohio. Think about Cleveland, Cincinnati, Columbus has a good orchestra, Dayton, Canton, it goes on. But the point being, it's not unusual for a city of Eugene's size, so 160,000 for the city of Eugene, probably 250 counting the metro area. Not unusual at all. I think what is unusual, and you alluded to it earlier, Mary, is I think pound for pound, we should be very, very proud of the orchestra we have here. This is really hard to say humbly at all, so I don't know how quite to do it, but I would be very happy to stack up the Eugene Symphony against an orchestra from a city 3 to 4 times our size. It's just one of those things that it's hard to know, really. It's not like there's a playoff system, you know, any given Sunday, who's going to say who's better. But artistically speaking, this is a very, very strong ensemble, and you should all be very proud.
What made it that way?
Well, that's a great question. I think particularly coming from such humble beginnings, and I'm looking at my dear friend Caroline Beckelheide, in whose living room the Eugene Symphony was founded in 1965 as an idea. Obviously, very community-based at that time, a series of concerts in people's houses, in churches, eventually moving into Bell Hall on the campus of the University of Oregon. Major step forward, clearly, in 1982 when the Holt Center opened and the Eugene Symphony was the first of the resident companies to be established there. A big quantum leap forward in 1989 with the appointment of Maren Alsop as music director, clearly transformative for the orchestra. That trend continued with Miguel Harth Bedoya being appointed in 1997 as music director, and again Giancarlo Guerrero in 2002, and our current music director, Daniel Rachev, in 2009. One of the things that Eugene Symphony is known for in this country is as the sort of launching pad of great careers. So Maren Alsop is now an internationally known conductor. You might have just heard the news that a couple of weeks ago she was the first woman in the 118-year history of the Proms Festival to conduct the last night of the Proms. It's a big deal. She was, I think, a nonplussed. I think her quote was, "It's hard to believe in 2013 there are still firsts for women," but she's happy to do it. But we're known as being a place where conductors go to get their big start. But along the way, you have people who care deeply, people who want to build the city that they wish to live in. And so it's people like Caroline, it's people like Betty Soaring, Carolyn Chambers, people who have invested their time, their energy, and most of all their passion in creating something that they want to have. If I think back to my youth growing up near Portland and where the Ducks were in the Pac-10 at the time, sort of perennial also-rans, scrappy but didn't finish near the top very often. If you think from 1985 to where we are now with the Ducks football team, it's a pretty big transformation. And it took, obviously, people who wanted to see it happen. And I think the same is true of the Eugene Symphony. It's people who invested and shared their passion.
Okay, so we got 8 programs a season, I think, for the regular season.
Nine. On the
okay.
Symphonic series. Maybe you missed one last year. I don't
know. Only had a half ticket, half season. But every time there's this little combination of 2 or 3 or 4 pieces, which, if you don't know a lot about it, it seems random, but they all sort of work. And if you look around at every week there's a newspaper description of all the stuff that's available musically for the week, and there's a million, you know, it's like everything else in Eugene, there's 100,000 people and 500,000 opinions on what's great.
Yeah.
How do you piece together a program that works?
It's a great question. It's, I would say, much more art than science. First of all, it starts with the vision of the music director. So Daniil Rachev, our music director and conductor, is a brilliant musician, I think a great communicator. The orchestra plays very well for him, very hard for him. They clearly enjoy playing under him. So it starts with, where does he think we are? What do we need to do? Does he think the audience wants to hear and also needs to hear? What does he think the orchestra needs to play in order to continue their artistic development? So that's the nucleus of the conversation. And then we sort of play around in the sandbox a little bit. We have a lot of ideas. I've now been at this. This will be my 23rd year in orchestra management. So I've been to a couple of concerts, roughly. Last count, something like 750 concerts that I've been to, and a lot of really great programming ideas. You're right, they're not random. If you just looked at it, the list of the season, and saw this overture followed by that concerto followed by that symphony, you wonder, okay, why that? Not every program has an obvious, what I would call, theme. I actually kind of don't like the word theme. To me, it sounds like all music written on a Tuesday, or all the composers' last name begin with R, or something like that. There needs to me, for me, a balance to a program. I like some words I'll throw out that I think about when we're building programs. Musical affinity, so either between the composers who wrote the pieces or the music itself. Sometimes we like to take the audience on a journey, so there's clearly a beginning, a middle, and an end. And not that we're telling an overt story, but there's some kind of process. There's some sort of place we're trying to get to. Sometimes programs can be about contrast, about music that is very different from each other, but somehow you learn something about both by comparing them. Sometimes it's about context. There might be a common idea that gets explored in different ways by different composers. I particularly like mixing genres of music, and I particularly like mixing eras of music. I think there's real power in putting a brand new piece next to a very old piece and explore that a little bit, learn a little bit what made the composer write the piece that they did. Sometimes I like mixing textures, so you don't necessarily want to hear the entire orchestra, all 83 members, playing at full roar all the time. Sometimes it's very interesting to hear a very small group right after a really big group. So those are the sort of the ingredients that go into the big stew pot. I would say one very technical part is there are limitations. We have a certain number of rehearsals, and if the orchestra doesn't know any of the music and it's all incredibly difficult, that's going to be a tough thing to get through in four rehearsals. By the same token, the Holt Center stage is quite large and sufficient to most of our needs, but it's not infinite. So space sometimes takes a factor. Sometimes there are physical things that have to move from one place to the next. These are the things that you as an audience are not supposed to care about. You just hope that somewhere someone thought of that, so there's not some 15-minute gap with nothing going on. We do try to think those things through. And some of it is how recently we played things. There is clearly a core repertoire. The Beethoven symphonies spring to mind. Most of us, if you've been coming to concerts, you will probably have heard the Beethoven symphonies. Probably the fifth the most, maybe the ninth, second most, maybe the third most, and so on, in some order. You can flip-flop those if you'd like, Mary. You're giving me a funny look there. But when was the last time you did the Beethoven's Fifth Symphony? Because you don't want to do it this year and next year and the year after that. Because even a masterpiece like Beethoven Fifth, the analogy I like to use is you got to let a little grass grow back on the hill before you mow it again. So you want to give it a little space, a little time, both for the orchestra and for the audience. So all of those factors sort of play in. And then the last piece, I think, is probably where you're getting at, is the audience itself. who are they, what do they want, what do they need, and who's the future audience. There's this always this continuum of, well, you've all heard, I'm sure, the adage, you dress for the job you want, not the job you have. So the question for us is, how do we program for the audience of the future without necessarily alienating the audience of the present? So it's a long arc, I would say, and we try to bear all of those things in mind. The underwriting, the underpinning principle really is balance. You want to have a program that makes sense, that each program in itself makes sense, that one program in context with the next program makes sense, so the September concert has some kind of flow to the October concert and throughout the season and over multiple seasons. And so at the end of the day, there hopefully will be some element of trust between the audience and the orchestra, and particularly the music director, that even if you don't know the piece of music on the program, you're probably going to like it, or even if you don't like it, you will respect that it was chosen because you believe you've had a good long relationship with the orchestra and the music director, and I trust you. Take me on a journey. Take me someplace that I don't know. I think it would be a shame if we only ever program things that people already know. That would kind of get boring, I would think. So, I don't know. Maybe we should take questions on that later.
We will, no doubt.
Yeah, okay.
So I've been my career in education and, perennially underfunded. The city of Eugene has lots of things to spend its money on. Our philanthropists have lots of things to spend their money on. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the balance of ways that you address the real challenge of serving not just people who can afford $17 or more for a seat, and people who can't but might nevertheless benefit from this rich cultural resource.
Sure. I think you're talking about access in a way.
Yeah, access.
I'll start with something you already mentioned, which is our entry point price for the symphonic series, the subscription series you all expect from the Eugene Symphony at the Holt Center. That's $17. I think that's the lowest entry price of any of the resident companies there. Furthermore, for students, our student price is $10, and that's not just a student rush last day only. If someone walked in with a student ID and wanted a ticket for next May's concert, we'd sell it to them for $10. So that's a standing rate. Furthermore, I would point out, 5 years ago, we established our free outdoor Symphony in the Park concert at the Cuthbert Amphitheater, and that is absolutely free. We have 5,000 people there this last July. It's a fabulous place. It's a wonderful venue. It's a wonderful mood, and that is our gift back to Eugene. It's our gift back to the people who have supported us, and also a way to introduce us to people who aren't coming yet. So in terms of access to the concerts themselves, I think that's a good place to start. Beyond that, though, we are much more than a performing arts organization. We are also an educational organization. And so we have an array of programs. We have, of course, the youth concerts that you would probably expect, what I like to call the yellow school bus concerts, where the elementary school kids get on the school bus and they drive down and park next to the hall and they all stream in like ducklings and get shown to their seats. It's how I was introduced to music in Portland when I was in second grade. I remember like it was yesterday. I remember where I sat. I remember one of the pieces they played. It was a really special experience for me. And I love those concerts. The mood, the excitement, the bubble of energy when the kids are walking in, and then the hush that goes over them when the music starts. It's absolutely priceless. Beyond the youth concerts, though, we also have new programs piloted in the last couple of years. We have a program called Symphonic Adventures, which takes curriculum directly into area classrooms. As you know, many of the school districts have struggled to maintain music in the schools. It's shame that the budgets have caused them to have to make such difficult choices. And I totally respect people like Shelley Berman and former Superintendent Nancy Golden, who fought very hard to keep music in Springfield. But they've had to make some choices that we wish they didn't have to make. So this is one of the places we're trying to fill that gap. Symphonic Adventures takes a music curriculum, identifying, explaining the four basic elements of music: melody, harmony, rhythm, timbre, and volunteers teach it at the end of each unit. Then one of our ensembles, so it might be a string trio, it might be a brass quintet, go in and play at third grade assemblies. And at the end of that, then they come to the youth concert. So they get on the school bus and they come down. So it's very sequential from theory to very sort of small, intimate, sort of interactive performance to the entire orchestra. And that is, I think, very low access. It's a sliding scale between $100 for the program and $500, depending on the percentage of free and reduced price lunch that the school has. But for the children itself, that's they do not pay for that. I believe most of the funding comes from PTOs. But so that's one program where access clearly is important. Another one is a program called Link Up. This is actually a curriculum developed by Carnegie Hall, so you know it's good. It's distributed nationally, and we partner with four schools this coming year in the Eugene 4J that have after-school programs. Now, many of you probably know that not every kid gets on the school bus after school and goes home to mom or dad. Some of them stay in place and then receive additional instruction or, you know, sports and things like that. So this is a program developed by Carnegie Hall. 16 weeks of lessons. We teach them how to read music, teach them how to sing, teach them how to play recorder. You remember the little elemental flute that we sometimes mm-hmm. played when we were kids? And at the end of it, they not only come to the youth concert, but they play on stage with the orchestra. And that program is completely free.
What school do you know this year?
It's a change from last year to this year. Okay. I don't have that off the top of my head, sorry.
So we can put that on our website.
Right. So in terms of access, we go beyond what's the lowest ticket price, but want to make sure that our music is being able to be heard, even if the schools are not able to provide it themselves.
So how does your overall event programming reflect the communities? Oh, no, we already did that one. Do you coordinate programming with other performance events? I mean, do you guys all get together once a year, once a month, and say, okay, I'm going to do the big symphony now. You should do the little thing over here, or the ballet's happening. Don't make it on the same night as the symphony. How do you make it all fit together?
Well, clearly there's coordination. There's one big hall, Silva Concert Hall at the Holt Center, and so there is an organization system that the Holt Center itself employs to make sure that everyone's at least equally unhappy with their dates. I'm kidding. They do a very nice job of that. In terms of programming, obviously we share some things in common. So there's ballet music that you put on the orchestra stage. There, the Bach Festival, we have a lot of common repertoire. And so there's a sort of a loose understanding that we sort of check in from time to time. I've had a good conversation with John Evans and Matthew Halls about what they're planning to do a couple of years from now, just to make sure that we're aware of each other's space. Beyond the exclusionary, I would say on the inclusionary side, we do reach out this coming November. Actually, some of it spills into October. We'll have our second Counterpoint initiative. This was a festival-style approach that was launched in 2011. Maybe some of you heard about it. It was all centered on the ideas of war and peace. And a citywide initiative, lots of different kinds of events, performance events, lecture events, discussions. So this coming November, we thought we'd go in a different direction, war and peace being, let's admit it, fairly heavy. We wanted to explore a different kind of concept, and so we're keying on the ideas of love and fate and how many stories have been told and ballets that have been danced and songs that have been sung throughout human history, really, of that eternal human compulsion to love and be loved in return. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. And, you know, a missed connection here, a chance encounter there. And if you think about some of those great stories, our tentpole concert on that festival is a first half of Romeo and Juliet that we're inviting three actors from the Shakespeare Festival in Ashland to come and do small snippets of scenes from the original Shakespeare woven in and around music from Prokofiev's ballet score for Romeo and Juliet. And that's just the first half. The second half is a concert version of Porgy and Bess, Gershwin's great opera. So two stories that have a kind of common element, that there's great love that is sparked, but and I'm sorry to say, in both those cases, it didn't work out very well. But around that, during the entire month, we've invited other performance groups, other scholarly lectures. The Oregon Contemporary Theater will have a play that has that same kind of approach. It's called Who Am I This Time, I think. Eugene Opera will have on their artists program a very obscure opera by the English composer Gustav Holst. They're going to do scenes from that. I had to look it up. The Vox Resonant, the wonderful a cappella ensemble, will do something. Oregon Mozart players, several professors at the University of Oregon, all exploring the same space. So I think there is great strength, especially in an arts-rich city like Eugene. And while I'm mentioning you should be proud of the Eugene Symphony, you should really be proud of all of the arts here in Eugene. It is an incredible place to see, consume, create, and experience art with others. There is great strength in this sort of comparative approach to our common humanity, and that's one of the things we like to do as one of the bigger arts organizations is get everyone in a room and dream a little.
I can't wait for the month of November.
Yeah. Watch for our brochure soon.
I shall. We'll put some out here. Okay, and the last question is what we would normally call the first question. In a recent Register Guard editorial, music critic and former Eugenian Tom Manoff characterized the 13-14 Eugene Symphony season as one offering, quote, 30 hours from dead composers with only 15 minutes from live ones, and complained that no commissions of new music, no minority outreach, avoidance of important social issues and programming all characterized the season. In contrast, an August 25th issue of the New Republic, just to show that you can be criticized from both extremes, critic Philip Kennicott discusses how an effort to popularize classical music undermines what makes orchestras great. He describes several examples of popular outreach that seem to have failed to draw in new audiences and have simply diluted the impact of ever scarcer philanthropic support. What do you have to say to these guys?
Well, I'll start with the first example, and I'll begin by saying Mr. Manoff absolutely is entitled to his opinion. I actually don't know him personally. We exchanged a couple of emails in advance of that article. He asked me, I think, a very specific question. I gave him a couple of very specific answers. And I reread his piece, thinking you might ask about this. I don't disagree with his opinion as much as people might think. I think the areas where we agree are that new music matters. I mean, I really believe that to my very core, and I believe that for a couple of reasons. First of all, it is our opportunity, our place in history, our time, us, to say something about ourselves, not only to each other, but also to future generations. I think it's incumbent on us to leave something of ourselves for others to know about us in the future. I'm going to throw out a couple of analogies, and the people that I work with, our board of directors and our staff, are coming to know that I really like to use analogies a lot to communicate. Sometimes they're a little weirder than others. But one of the first analogies I use is arts organizations can be both a telescope and a mirror. So the telescope part comes in when you see a distant culture, whether it's in a different place on the planet or a different time in history, but you look through it to see what the people were like and how what their experience was and in what ways that experience is common with our experience now and also in what ways it's different from our experience now. The mirror part is when we can hold this reflective surface up to ourselves and see who we are and experience that through the lives, through the eyes and ears of artists such as composers and playwrights. And we have to be constantly assessing ourselves as humans and comparing ourselves to those who come before and those who will come after. The other analogy I'll throw out as, and this is kind of mixing metaphors a little bit, so bear with me, is we both need to be an art museum and an art gallery. I don't want the orchestra to just be the dustiest wing of the art museum where you just go to revisit the old masters again and again. Oh, I love that Rembrandt. You know, I love that Van Gogh. It just sort of reinforces and reassures you. Sometimes you go to an art gallery and you see a piece that really kind of shocks you, and it makes you reassess, boy, I didn't know that was art. Who am I? Do I know enough? So you need to be challenged from time to time. And I think to be a successful arts organization moving into the future, you need to be both. You need to have an art museum wing and an art gallery wing. And again, going back to the comment I made earlier about the power in juxtaposing new music and old music, is sometimes those intersections of the wings of the museum. And I'm looking at my friend Greg Fitzgerald, who recently was the president of the Jordan-Schnitzer Museum of Art. Sometimes the power is in those intersections where you have the old wing next to the new wing, and you literally walk from one to the next and see what's different and what's the same. So that's where I think Mr. Manoff and I would probably agree. The part that I wish he had said and didn't He did leave out the fact that we did have a world premiere in April, a brand new clarinet concerto written for us by Tomas Svoboda, incredibly well received. It was a completely packed house. I would argue many of them probably there to hear Carmina Burana, but we're delighted to hear this brand new piece. Extremely well written, extremely well played. I should point out it was just on a performance today, a week ago today, our first national radio broadcast in about 20 years. So a big deal for us. And so Mr. Manoff left that part out. He also did not mention our long history of having composer residencies. Over the last 10 to 12 years, we've had some major American composers come and stay for a week. We play their music. The composers teach in the community. People like Jennifer Higdon, John Corigliano, Michael Dougherty, the list kind of goes on. And that's a series that we will be reestablishing. What Mr. Manoff couldn't know is, as we are looking forward to our 50th anniversary in two seasons, so we're just starting 48th season now, so two seasons hence, we will have three commissions, brand new world premieres, custom built for us to help us celebrate that momentous milestone. So new music matters, and it is part of the Eugene Symphony, and it will be part of the Eugene Symphony. It has to be for all of us. So that's item one. Do you want me to go on the New Republic article? All right. Yeah, Mr. Kennicott's article, much longer, first of all. It's, I think, a fairly scholarly piece. The part that I'll flip-flop. The last time I started with the part that I agreed with, not the part I disagreed with. The part that I disagree with seems to me in that piece the core tenet is that as American orchestras are seeking to engage audiences in different ways, they're pulling the focus away from the stage and the music itself. I think the quote that jumped out at me was that orchestras will lose goodwill among their traditional audiences. To me, that's an awfully black and white response. It's almost like there's a Venn diagram where the circles never touch. I mean, if we did a show of hands here in the room, this probably doesn't make for great radio, but how many people would only ever come to a classical music performance, and then how many people would only ever come, and I mean ever come, to a jazz performance? How many people would say raise their hand for only classical and then only jazz? Okay, we got one. The reality is we have such great access now, more access to music than at any time in human history. I mean, I got a phone in my pocket, and in 30 seconds I could download a song that I'd never heard of and listen to it right now. We're kind of polyglots as people. We listen to many different kinds of music. We experience life in so many different faceted ways. There's such a broad spectrum upon which we can draw. To borrow another arts analogy, it's an incredible palette with which we can paint. I just don't buy that doing music. I'll take a step back. So when I was in North Carolina for 12 years, which is a deeply musical state, I have to say, the birthing grounds of a great many different kinds of music. And one of the most powerful programs that we put together there was coinciding with the orchestra's 75th anniversary. We wanted to do sort of a history of North Carolina music. And so we combined the orchestra with bluegrass musicians and this very cool variant of the blues called the Piedmont Blues. At a later subsequent concert, we combined it with something that's called beach music, which is kind of a very obscure corner of swing band. And it was a fascinating experience. The audience absolutely loved it. There's something very powerful about adding an orchestra. To me, it's the most incredible instrument ever invented. Any combination of sounds the human imagination can dream up, a modern orchestra can do it. So why would you not combine that with other kinds of music? I don't think there's anything lost. And I will say, having done several of these performances, combining the orchestra with, I mean, I hate to use the word popular because it sounds like classical music is not popular, but we'll just say pop, did not diminish at all their ability to play Beethoven well. So I do reject the premise of Kennicott's article that you're somehow watering down the core product. The part that I agree with, he does have a quote in there, that music is the bedrock on which orchestras were founded and on which they will survive. I buy that, sure. The music is who we are. It's what we do. That said, I do think we in the 21st century need to diversify. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. One of the phrases I've used in the office lately is, I think in the future, and I'm talking about American orchestras, and I'm also talking about Eugene Symphony, excuse me, we need to be playing more kinds of music for more kinds of people in more kinds of places. So I think you have that to look forward to.
Wow. Thanks, Scott. Well, we'll break now for our members to develop questions at their tables. And then when we come back, Scott Freck from the Eugene Symphony Orchestra will answer your questions.
You're tuned to KLCC Eugene, 89.7, 90.5 KLCO Newport, KLFR Reedsport, 89.1, and at 88.1 KMPQ Roseburg, KLFO Florence, KLBR Bend, and on the web at klcc.org.
And we're back with Eugene Symphony Executive Director Scott Freck. And I'll start with a question from our cameraman today, John DeLow.
Okay.
And he said, I hear you only have four rehearsals together. How do the musicians prepare such demanding pieces with such limited time together?
Well, it's kind of an extraordinary thing, really. First of all, these are incredible professional musicians that have spent years and years honing their individual craft. And, of course, they're also a product of multiple years playing together. So, in fact, we have one musician, Amy Jo Butler, who was played in the very first season, 1965, and is still in the orchestra. We have another, Sharon Smith, who joined in the second season, and so she's still playing. So there is a certain aspect of cumulative experience together. That said, they don't just get the parts morning of the rehearsal. They do have an opportunity a few weeks in advance. It depends sometimes on rental music, how far we get in advance, but between 2 and 4 weeks so that they can work on them individually so that when we first put them together on Saturday morning, then for this coming Thursday's concert, which is opening night, September 26th, rehearsal starts on Saturday. If you're hearing this on the radio, it started a couple of days ago. But and between Saturday morning, Sunday night, Tuesday night, Wednesday night, Donahue and the orchestra put it all together. It's an extraordinary process. If you played in high school band when you were a kid and you worked on the same program for, I don't know, 2 months, 3 months, and you had one big night at the end of it, it's not like that. It goes a lot faster. These are professional musicians operating a very, very high level. But like I said, not all things are possible in four rehearsals. There are some programs that you could dream up that you would need six. And economically, that isn't so viable. It's not like the audience is going to pay extra because you rehearsed more. So there's a product of economics there, too. So I hope that answers the question.
Karen Seidel, City Club member and another Eugene Symphony founder. Our table would like to know about the background of the symphony's new concert mistress.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you very much, Karen. So we have a brand new concert master starting this Thursday night, opening night. Sammy Park is a violinist. And if you don't know what concert master is, that's the first chair, first violin. So the first violin section and the principal of that section. Each of the sections have what we call a principal, and most of them an assistant principal. Concert master is sort of pride of place in the orchestra. Historically, going way back into Baroque music, the concert master led the orchestra. There was no conductor. And in fact, in Britain, the concert master is called the leader, which I think is interesting. Sayami is from Los Angeles. She's born of Korean parents. She played for many years in the L.A. area, playing in the Pacific Symphony, subbing in the L.A. Phil. She played in hundreds of, and I mean literally hundreds of film scores in the Hollywood studio scene, and recently relocated to Portland, where her husband got a job. And so she'll be commuting down for our program. She is delightful. She's an extraordinary musician. In fact, she gave a recital for some of our patrons last month that blew my socks off. She's fantastic. So delighted to welcome her to the orchestra. We haven't had a new concertmaster in about 10 years. Catherine Luchtenberg, our previous concertmaster, retired a couple of years ago. That's not a job you fill overnight. So we took our time and found just the right one. And Sayami is, she's it. You're going to love her. Hi. Oh, you lost your mic.
There may be a message there. I'm Marge Ramey, City Club member for many years. I was interested in your talking to us about the financial end of the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
You call the musicians professional. Is that just a kind term, or are they paid?
They are paid.
Carolyn Beckelheide explains to me that in the very beginning, the union paid for some of them. And are they all unionized?
They are.
And how do you negotiate with that?
Well, that's a lot of questions all at once. They are professional. There is a minimum scale. I believe this year the minimum is $107 and some odd cents per service, so each rehearsal or concerts as one unit. It goes up from there depending on position. So I mentioned principals before. Principals get a standard, what we call in the industry, overscale of 25%. So there is a union. They are members of the local of the American Federation of Musicians, which is an international musicians union, the International Musicians Union. And we do have a collective bargaining agreement, a contract that both sets out economic terms and also work rules. That negotiation, typically there are multi-year contracts. My fourth day on the job in June of 2012, I had my first collective bargaining session with the musicians. It was a quick way to get to know some of them. They're represented by five members of what they call the orchestra committee. They're wonderful people. They're very smart and intelligent. They're great partners. We had a good series of discussions and settled a two-year contract in September. And I think they're reasonably happy with it. We're reasonably happy with it. We're in this for the long haul, and I think they know that. They're partners in that. It's a process. Did they get everything they wanted in negotiations? I bet they didn't. Did we get everything we wanted in negotiations? No, we did not. But that's the way it works. It's a compromise. Politics is the art of the possible.
Dina Will, City Club member. A member at our table wanted to know if you'd considered a theme with an Oregon connection, either composers who were born in Oregon, or music that is about Oregon, or some form of an Oregon connection, either for a season or for one program where you just played Oregon concert music.
Yeah, well, I think it's a really wonderful idea, actually. I've been toying with, I mentioned earlier, the 50th anniversary that we're coming up on in 2015-16, and so many different ways you could go with that. Obviously, we want to revisit our history, think through some of the wonderful programs and performances, the opening night at the Holt Center. I'm sure we'll try to draw on that as a source of inspiration. Don't want to let too many cats out of too many bags, but we'd love to see some of our former music directors come back for a visit. I'll just throw that out there. We're working on that. And I do like the idea of where does Oregon fit into the national music scene. It's, for example, a couple of Oregon-born composers. Lou Harrison was born in Portland. I think a very significant composer in the 20th century. Morton Lauritsen, Oregon-born. Robert Keir, who teaches here at the university, is a substantial composer on the national scene. So how you weave that together, I don't know. But I've been thinking about that, too, and we'll see where it leads us. It's a good question. Thank you.
And don't forget Ernst Bloch.
Ernest Bloch, thank you. Well, not born in Oregon. He was born in Switzerland, but spent his latter years here and died at Daggett Beach in 1959, I believe. I knew Ernest's grandson, Ernie, a sweet guy.
I'm Elliot McIntyre, City Club member. I was pleased to hear the clarinet concerto on performance today, the other day.
Yeah, wasn't that fun?
But as far as I know, that's the first time that I've ever heard this anything from the symphony on performance today. I think that's a great outlet. Is there any prospect of getting more exposure there? I think it's great for the symphony, great for the city.
Yeah, well, thank you very much. It was exciting, I have to say. We had a little listening party in the office with some of our patrons and all of our staff, and it was kind of a thrill to hear a national radio broadcast with the words Eugene Symphony in it. And I have to say, the musicians covered themselves in glory. It was a fantastic performance. Difficult piece. World premiere, nope, there's no reference recording you can draw upon to figure out how it goes. It's a process of discovery. But to the radio, the future prospects question, and it kind of ties into the union question, which is a broadcast of that nature does cost us extra. So we pay the musicians for the live performance. We have negotiated in our local CBA, our collective bargaining agreement, that the broadcasts you hear on KWAX are gratis. You're allowed to do that. You can negotiate locally. But that's for locally originated broadcasts. When it's nationally syndicated like that, you're now into a national union arena, and so there is a minimum rate for that. We did a little bit of extra fundraising in order to pay for that. We had this opportunity, and our patrons stepped up to the plate and fortunately supported us with the funds we needed to pay the musicians that much extra. I would do it again in a heartbeat. It was really wonderful. And I think edifying for the musicians to know that their performances are reaching beyond not only Eugene, not only Oregon, but into all of the United States. It was a big day.
Wonderful. My name's Jim Dotson. I'm a City Club member, and I've been privileged to be a board member of several of the different classical music organizations in this town. And I'm also very privileged to be part of your chorus.
Ah,
and
nice.
I will be part of that Porgy and Bess thing.
That's wonderful.
Sent out a thing. But I have a question that I don't know whether it's appropriate or not, but when you go through the list of prior conductors of the orchestra, mm-hmm. there's a name that's very nationally prominent, but it doesn't show up much, and that's Bill McLaughlin. The reason for why he's left off of that list sometimes?
Well, keep in mind, I'm the new
not
guy.
Not meaning to make you uncomfortable, but it's just a question.
Thank you. Keeping in mind, I'm the new guy. I know Giancarlo and Miguel and Marin from previous places. Obviously, they haven't been here since I've been here. I have not had a chance to meet Mr. McLaughlin yet. It's a part of our history that I have to say that I don't know very well yet. But as we come upon this 50th anniversary, we are going to be looking back to all of our former leaders, and that includes former board members. We are planning to interview people like Caroline to relive our history, really capture it, and do a good job of archiving. And I would love to have a conversation with Mr. McLaughlin to understand his role in the Eugene Symphony's development. What shape that conversation takes, I don't know yet, but it is a perfect opportunity. A major milestone like 50 years gives you a great chance to explore and remember. So we'll see.
John Quilter, City Club guest. I was just wondering whether the orchestra ever goes on tour as revenue enhancement possibilities and
sure.
Maybe piggyback on already prepared programs that might be enjoyed in other cities.
Great. Wonderful question. I'm glad you asked. Yes, actually we do. Last season we took a program to Florence. If you saw the Beethoven Violin Concerto and Bartok Concerto for Orchestra in March, we the very next night put it all on a bus and a truck and took it over to our friends in Florence. We were presented by a wonderful group there. And in May we took the program with the Berlioz Herald in Italy and Dvorak Symphony No. 8 down to Roseburg. I think it's incumbent on us as the orchestra for the Southern Willamette Valley to travel. We do have another engagement this coming year in April in Florence. I'm looking to expand upon that. Another one in Roseburg soon. I'd love to get over to Bend. I think our summer concert that many of you have seen at the Cuthbert Amphitheater, that would travel really well. I'd love to get that over the mountains. I would like to see if we can look north a little bit. There is no orchestra in Salem. The Oregon Symphony has a branch in Salem, although it looks to me like there's a lot of people there and not quite enough concerts, so we'll see. That was not a shot across the bow at my dear friends at the Oregon Symphony, with whom I worked for many years. But there's growth opportunity here. We are the orchestra for a several hundred mile radius, and I think we need to act like it.
Frank Carlton, a symphony subscriber for 13 years or so. I've been surveyed a number of times, and I just wondered if you guys do a demographic analysis or anything you could tell us about the age and the income and the what have you of our audience.
Well, Frank, funny you should ask. We haven't done one since I've been here. A major demographic survey like that is quite an undertaking. I'm going to make a bunch of noise for the radio and look in my notes. I recently came across one that had been done in 2011, and this, in a way, speaks to something else that was in Mr. Manoff's article. Here it is. He said, and I quote, that our median age was perhaps 60. The demographic survey that from 2011, so this is only a couple of years stale. The surprising thing that I found here, and I don't have a median age, I don't have the raw data that went into this, I just discovered this, and in any office, any organization that's been around for 48 years, there's a lot of stuff, and I have not looked through all of the stuff yet. But I did discover this. The biggest part of the bell curve for age is 45 to 54 years, and that's 44.3% of the audience. So if you were imagining a bell curve, that the middle part is really tall, and more than double the next demographic segment, which is 55 to 64, that's 20%. So if you add up all the years 19 to 35, 1944, that's something like 7%. So, but the biggest part is 45 to 54, and then it drops off, and then 75 plus goes back up a little bit again. That reminds me a little bit of a conversation I once had with James DePriest, who was the music director for the Oregon Symphony from 1980 to 2003, and sadly just passed away in February. One of the great men, minds, human beings I've ever known. And I said, I was 22 at the time, 23, excuse me, and thinking, what's wrong with us? Why are there no people who look like me there? I'm young, I like classical music, what's wrong? And he said, don't worry. For some people, it takes them a while. And you have to get into a place where you have time in your lives, and that's usually hits around 45. He said 45, and I look at this demographic survey, it says 45. Jimmy was right. You need to have bandwidth, you need to have discretionary income in some measure, and you need to have probably had your kids get to the point where they don't need a babysitter all the time. So I do have economic data here too, but it looks like we're wrapping up.
No, actually, we have a little time.
Oh, okay.
And so I want to ask for a story. This is Mary Layton again.
Okay.
I just remember when we chatted about this program, you had a couple of stories about times you had to get somebody, you had to get a substitute, like somebody broke.
Oh, boy,
something.
I did.
Well, it seems in my mind it's around the time I mentioned the violinist whose encore made us laugh.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And you said, oh, and then you told the whole story about how, and I thought, how do you find a substitute violinist of that quality? And you told me how it happened.
Yeah, well, if you were scoring at home last March, the Beethoven Violin Concerto I mentioned, the published brochure had this wonderful violinist named Stefan Jakiv, who has been to Eugene before. The audience loved him. And about 3 weeks, maybe 4 weeks before that engagement, I got a call from his manager. He has an injury, or had an injury. I think he's past it now, but nothing threatening for his career. But he really was under doctor advisement not to play for, basically give it some rest for about 6 weeks. And so he had to cancel. And so had to replace him with a different violinist. Fortunately, there are many wonderful, amazing violinists who are out there, and many of them have representation, so they're represented by professional agencies, and I know a lot of those people, and so I called around, and Mary, I'm telling you, 3 weeks for a cancellation is an eternity. It was forever. I've had cancellations on 12 hours, and that's hard. 24 hours is hard. The worst one I ever had to do, actually the hardest one, not the worst, the hardest one was a very custom-built program that we had done in North Carolina for the music director there, Grant Llewellyn, one of my dear friends, and he will be a guest conductor here in April. I can't wait to see him again. But a technically very demanding program. Structure, it was a portrait of the American composer John Adams. And if you saw Nixon in China a couple of years ago, that was written by John Adams that Eugene Opera had done. And for this program, it was not all Adams. We kind of expected that maybe drawing an audience for an all Adams evening might be tough in Raleigh, North Carolina. But the first part was influences, a work by Beethoven, a work by Benjamin Britten, a work by Charles Ives, and then three works by Adams, including his masterpiece called Harmonium for chorus and orchestra. Very, very difficult for everybody. It's a tour de force. And unfortunately, Grant's wife had emergency surgery, and he had to be home to be with her. And so on about a week and a half, I had to replace him, for whom we had built this very meaningful custom organized program, had to replace him on about a week and a half's notice. And that was tough, because we had many conductors who had availability but looked at the program and said, I'm not doing that. So we wound up with a gentleman who I think did very, very well under the circumstances. It's a shame that I didn't get to hear Grant conduct it, because it was our concept together. But 3 weeks for a cancellation, no problem.
Oh, no, I wasn't going to close the program. I actually had a question.
Okay.
Here we go.
Hi, Marty.
So when I was in high school, we had not just a band, but we had a concert band, a jazz band, an orchestra, a sing ensemble, a marching band, and a pep band.
Wow.
And so we are hosting an exchange student, and not to mention the choral opportunities, which we had a similar number of organizations, including, I forgot, the pit band, the pit orchestra
for
the drama program. We've seen a lot of cuts here in Oregon in music education. As a parent of younger children now, but they'll eventually be going out. What are the opportunities out there outside of the schools now, since the opportunities within the schools have really been cut back?
Yeah, I'll address the school part first. Not every opportunity has been cut. I don't want to make it sound like music is absent from public schools. That's not true. It really varies, not just by district to district, but sometimes school to school. You might have heard of this concept called site-based management, where principals get to decide where their resources are spent. I think that can be good, it can be bad. The places, obviously, where I think it's bad are where principals have decided that music is discretionary, that it's somehow some kind of luxury. I think that's a mistake, obviously. I think math is important. I think science is important. I think being a human being is important, and the arts help us do that. So music is not completely absent. For example, there's a strong program at Roosevelt Middle School for the orchestra. The reason I know that is my daughter is in it. So that's good. Beyond that, I will say one of our partner organizations, the Eugene Springfield Youth Orchestras, does a very good job. They have the string program starting as early as, I think, third grade and moving on up. They have two full orchestras and one string orchestra. And I'm really happy. Both of my children are in that program and advancing and doing very well by it. And there's many other such opportunities. I know that the Shedd Institute has lessons. There are places to get this, even if it's not institutional. Don't give up hope.
John DeLow, City Club, ex-cameraman. And
weren't you the cameraman like 2 minutes ago?
Yes. And we got Dan doing it now. You had to ask the question about who would just go to a classical concert and who would just go to a modern concert. Mm-hmm. And I raised my hand as the only one that would only go to a classical. And we talked about that. I said that music to me should be emotional, not intellectual. And you came back with something about there is today, there's newer music that is going back to being emotional as opposed to being an intellectual. And could you expound on that?
Sure, yeah. I think your comment was, and this was during the break when we were off air, that you really haven't heard anything written after 1910 in the classical sort of mold that you would want to hear. And I think I said, boy, I could show you a few things that you might actually enjoy. You know, the middle part of the 20th century, a lot of the music, the so-called, and these are not my terms, I disavow them, serious art music, I'm making air quotes for those of you hearing on the radio, took it into a very intellectual, almost mathematical kind of place. If you think about the 12-tone system pioneered by Viennese composer Arnold Schoenberg and used by others, there are some very valuable pieces of music written in that style. Most of it probably isn't going to be heard for all that long. It doesn't speak to the heart, I think. And I hear where you're coming from. Music is emotional. I think a really great piece of music speaks to both the head and the heart. It's both intellectual and visceral. So that said, in the latter part of the 20th century, there has been the pendulum has swung back towards I wouldn't say romanticism. I mean, I wouldn't even say post-romanticism, but an acknowledgement that it's about the soul as much as it is as about the brain. So I think there is great music written in the last. We'll set aside the 1910 part. In the last 10 years, 20 years, 1 year, I wish you could have heard the clarinet concerto that we premiered just 4 months ago. It's a deeply felt piece of music and a really genuine human soul speaking there. So don't write it all off as don't paint it all with the same brush as it's not for me. Some of it might not be for you, and I say that to every time someone complains about programming, and occasionally they do. I know that's a surprise, but I will tell them a couple of things. I first of all, I will apologize that they didn't like it as much as they wanted to, and that's a genuine statement. I'm sorry you didn't like it. I know you wanted to like it, and I'm sorry you didn't. That said, we have programmed for so many different people, so many different tastes. We can't possibly make everybody happy all the time, and frankly, if that was our goal, I think it would be really boring. It would be bland. Oh, I can say that we picked each piece with a great deal of care, that we believe that each piece of music that we choose has value and deserves to be heard. And then lastly, the orchestra's going to play the heck out of it. The orchestra's going to commit to it and go for it. At the end of all of that, I cannot guarantee that you're going to like everything. And I shouldn't guarantee that you're going to like everything. I don't know. I don't know you. But I can say, give it a shot. We think it has value.
I can guarantee that we are sincerely grateful for to Scott Freck from the Eugene Symphony Association, the director of the programming, to come and talk to us today and explain to us how you put a program together. And we look forward to this year's season. That's Scott here. How we appreciate
thank you.
It. Now, before Marty comes on to close us down for the day, I want to remind you of two activities of City Club that are unusual and that should be on your calendar and you should be thinking about participating in. One is the October 20 City Club Follies. It is a fundraiser. We just heard today that Bob Welch has agreed to let us play a couple of his songs, making gentle fun of issues in the community. We also have the Three of Hearts, Lawrence Crumb. I've heard that Sandra Bishop has written one on Obamacare. So we are looking forward to seeing you from 5 to 7 at Cosmic Pizza. You buy your own dinner, and you buy your votes to tell who's the best of the lot. And the second thing is, this Tuesday, City Club and Lane Workforce Partnership start on a brand new enterprise. We are offering a course in the economy and employment in Lane County. It is for teachers. We have teachers from all over the region participating in this. It is offered free as a part of the mission of City Club to bring clarity and vision to our civic conversations and of Lane Workforce Partnership, which is trying to develop a broader appreciation of the nature of economy and employment in Lane County. So just pay attention.
Well, gentle fun or not, our next program will be next week, September 27th, here at the Eugene Hilton on the 12th floor for the future of Civic Stadium. So we hope to see you then. Mm. Thank you for coming.